Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. My mother, Caroline Kilborn, is not joining us today, but check in next week, and one of these weeks she'll be back. She's taken a little bit of a break. She can't, at 86, it's a little hard for her to read a book a week, so she likes to take a little bit of a break sometimes and not do every single show with me. So I'm having to fly solo here. And just for those who don't know the history, my Caroline was on the radio for years and years, like through my late childhood, teen years. She had a local radio show. And so when I had the opportunity to start doing the show in 2006, I said, okay, I'm going to do it with Mom. And so she's been my support with this all along. And we've been doing this since 2006. And most of our shows are up on writersvoices.com. So anyway, our guest today is Galia Gishon. Did I say that right?
You did.
All right. And Galia spent nearly 10 years writing financial research for top investment banks before launching Down to Earth Finance, a top personal financial advising firm in New York. And Galia is the author of My Money Matters, a personal finance book which received notable press from the New York Times and many other places. She frequently leads seminars for Barnard College, where she has taught for 13 years. She's an avid angel investor focusing on women-led and impact startups, and actively counsels startups through accelerators. However, the book we're talking about today has nothing to do with any of that.
Well, it sounds like it doesn't, but yeah. It doesn't, but there, believe it or not, there's more overlap there than you would.
Well, let's talk about that. So we are talking about The Accidental Suffragist, which is a historical novel centered on the women's suffrage movement in New York City in 1911, following the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory, which many of us learned about in history class, at least I did many years ago. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Galia.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me here. I really appreciate it.
So let's just start out with why did you decide to write about this topic, and how does it relate to your long and storied career in personal finance?
Yeah, which is really my day job, is how I pay my bills. You know, put my kids through college or all that fun stuff. Not that writing doesn't pay, but right now.
Exactly.
I hope that I could quit my day job one of these days, right? No, actually, I'm kidding, but So I will say that from the get-go, I've always been an avid reader. I love to read. I've been reading ever since I could, and I always had a book in my hand. Reading is my happy and safe place. So that's something that is, and reading fiction mostly. So that's something that, even though I am working in finance, like, I've always been a reader. And I lived in New York City for a long time, and then when I moved to Connecticut, just when my children were little, I was kind of just looking for something as an outlet for me that was just dealing with the transition and move. And so a friend of mine said, why don't you take a writing class in my town? There's actually a lot of really wonderful writing communities. And I did. I thought, oh, this will be like a great thing to do, like when I'm not working and when I don't have the kids. And next thing I know, I wrote a book. So I started taking writing classes, and it was more just because I didn't really know where to begin. I thought, well, let me focus on historical fiction because it's what I read. It's probably the genre that I gravitate towards, number one. And I am a feminist. And, you know, when you talk about the overlap with my day job and my career, is I really believe in financial empowerment for women. And that's what I've spent most of my career doing. And so as someone who really believes in women's rights and women equality and gender equality, I thought, well, I love historical fiction, and that's just anything historical. And if I could write something, let me look at a time era that I really love and that I admire and want to learn more about. And so that was a suffragist. So that's the very long story how that came about. But I really started taking writing classes, five, six, 7 years ago. And I it's probably the one thing on my calendar that I just don't miss. I'm already halfway through my second novel that I'm writing. Literally last night, I went to a happy hour with writers in my town. It has become such an integral part of my community and what I do.
Well, that's a wonderful story. That's great. So, historical fiction is something that I gravitate to as well, and actually, I have kind of a lot in common with you because my day job is I'm a CFO. So,
Oh my gosh. I didn't know that. That's
yes, of a company that I founded, that I co-founded
Oh
in
my gosh.
1996, and it's we're a manufacturer, design and manufacturer of consumer products, mostly in the home and car fragrance space. So, yeah, so
That's
I
awesome.
deal with numbers a lot, although I, do a lot of other things in the company too, but I also love to read and love to write and love books and am very drawn to historical fiction. So, so let's talk about how you decided to, when you decided to write about the suffragist movement, you decided not to focus on one of the better known suffragists, although they do appear in the book, particularly Alice Paul, I think is what probably the best known of the characters that appear in your book. So tell me how that thought process went and how why you decided to focus on a working class woman who was kind of an anomaly in the movement at the time.
Yeah, I think that the book that is today is not what I started out to write. And so I initially really wanted to focus on Susan B. Anthony because that's what I knew, and I started researching, and I had wrote a short story about it, and it wasn't pulling me, frankly, and it wasn't, and I wanted the historical fiction part. I actually read this book called The Orphan Train about 10 years ago, and I loved that it was a made up story that brought conflict and intrigue in a historical fact. So I thought, well, if I'm going to write about a suffragist, I have to write about someone who's dealing with conflict. And frankly, just maybe it's our background. I don't know, but what the conflict that came to me was financial and economic hardship. And I thought, well, gosh, like most of the suffragists were wealthy women. And it's because they really had the opportunity to volunteer because somebody else was taking care of their kids and cleaning their home. And so it's
Right.
not, and look, it's so admirable that they did what they did, but as a reader, and then you really want to read about a group of rich women. I don't know. That wasn't what I was drawn to. And I thought, well, how am I going to sell that? And do I even want to read about that? And I don't know. It just came to me about, well, if someone's really struggling economically and it's more of a challenge and an obstacle to them, isn't that more intriguing and more attractive? That's really how it
Yeah.
came about. And you've got more to lose to some extent, right?
Yes. Now, it was and you portray that in that Helen, your protagonist, gets very little support from anyone else in her life to do
I
this.
know.
So
Which is the facts. I mean, let's face it. I really struggled with how to write her husband, but most men of that time would not have been like, I didn't want to write him as this absolute pushover, be like, of course, Helen, you go out there and volunteer with the suffragists. That wasn't realistic. And I didn't want to make him this like absolute like terror monster either, because that didn't feel good to me. So I think making him where he did, ultimately he did support her, but listen, he also gave her a little bit of a hard time around it. I think that seems the most realistic to me as somebody who.
That makes sense. Now, were you in your research able to identify any women like Helen, who come from that background?
Yes and no. There were women who volunteered, and especially when you look at the March in Washington, and there were women who were working women, doctors, lawyers, nurses, which there were so few of them. And there were women from a working class and a lot of the labor union activists, but there wasn't anyone who stood out that I thought, oh gosh, this is a great story, because I actually did look for that. But absolutely, I mean, it's just But really, the main women who got it passed were the, Alice Paul. There was another woman who I don't talk about in the book, Carrie. I'm blanking on her last name. Obviously, Harriet Stanton Blatch, Lucy Burns. Like, really, these were the main women who actually got it passed. But most of them were women of means, which, you know what? I'm just thankful they did
Right.
it.
And
But yes,
in some
they were.
cases they had husbands who were very supportive, or fathers.
Yeah. Like in
Not
the
always.
end, these women. No. In the end, these women who when, I don't want to give it away, but when they, are stuck with the police and such, they actually lawyers are called upon, and they wouldn't have done it if they weren't, if the husbands weren't available. So.
Right. I know part of reading this is kind of painful in a way because
I know.
of it isn't that long ago. It isn't that long ago. I mean, this is in my grandmother's lifetime, and women had so many obstacles. They faced so many obstacles, and other people did too. I mean, working class men also were not very, didn't have very easy lives in a lot of way. And the union movement and how challenging and difficult it was for, and in some ways we've made a lot of progress, but it feels like we're going backwards again.
Oh, I know. You know how many times I would read a chapter in class, and I probably had 20 or 30 people with the different classes that I took, and almost every week someone would say, "Gosh, have things even changed?" It would, because you there were. I'd like to think we have moved ahead, but there were many things that don't that seem like we haven't. So yes, I agree. I know it, there's some things that feels like they haven't changed, and that's where it's interesting. Where I'm not an activist, nor want to be, nor I don't have political aspirations, anything like that. But what has come up in so many of these conversations, like I did a podcast in Georgia, I did a podcast in Texas, just really around the book or an interview, and they say, "How is this book relevant today?" Because it really did happen years, 100 years ago, and the first thing I say is, "Oh my goodness, look at what's happening with voting laws being contested in Georgia." And I'm from the South originally. I mean, I literally wrote 300, 500 postcards last year during the election because of like voters being taken off voting rolls. And again, I'm not, it's something I've defaulted to, but it's nothing that it's my mission per se. But I think when you see the how weak the voting laws are and how quickly they're taken away, I think this book is very timely. And then even what's happening with women's rights, whatever you agree in Texas, like it's still such a debate. It's still so relevant that learning where we came from to me is really important.
It is. And the people of that time, even the women of that time, so many, they just accepted this idea that, well, why should women vote? What purpose does that serve? Why should they? They have husbands, the husbands vote. And it was just so ingrained and so accepted. It's hard to wrap our minds around that now, but it could happen again. And it is still this way in some parts of the world where women don't have the right to vote, where nobody has the right to vote,
It could. I mean, it's in many working countries, and I mean, frankly, here, if you're not on a voting roll, or if you don't get, or what if you have to work full time? Like, I'm fortunate that I have a career, like even during COVID, that I can work from home and I'm still able to support myself and do well, and I don't have to be exposed to any health risks and such. What if I didn't have that choice and I had to work someplace? I was in person and I was exposed to obviously COVID. But then what if I couldn't take the day off to work or to vote, excuse me, or stand in line? Like when I went to vote for the presidential election, I literally got in line at 5 in the morning and was able to vote by 11 a.m.
You're
Like what if
kidding
I didn't
me.
have the luxury? No,
Oh my
because so many
gosh.
people, yeah, and I did it without even thinking about it. We actually got there early because we wanted to do before work. We ended up waiting 6 hours. What if I didn't have the luxury of skipping work that morning or going to work late because I would get fired from my job, which is really who we're targeting here, who's being affected. So I do think this book, well, look, I want this book to be entertaining, most of all. I want you to read it because you liked it and you enjoyed it and you want to recommend it to your friends or your family, and you like to read and you're entertained by it. But I do think this book is really relevant in terms of the subject matter.
I agree. I agree. And you know, there's a very common saying that those who don't, what, something about learning history, if you don't learn from history, you're doomed to repeat it. And if we forget
Oh,
if we don't keep these things, and you know, not to get too political, but this is part of this push now to basically whitewash our history and not teach
right.
things that were, that are unpleasant from the past. Yeah, we have to keep, we have to understand these things. We have to say, oh wow, this was really awful. People did awful
Right.
things, and we don't want to do that again, and we're not going to let it happen again. But if you don't learn it, if you don't know it, and if you don't teach it to kids in school, then they aren't going to know it. And if someone tells them when they're 25 years old, hey, did you know that this happened? They're like, huh? Nah, that didn't happen. I didn't learn about it in school.
Right. And I think too that even I, who I think I'm fairly well read, and it's interesting because so I, like you, I studied finance and accounting. So I actually didn't learn so much. I mean, I learned very, I think, basic fundamental history. But I still thought, okay, well, I'm well read, I'm educated. I couldn't believe how much I didn't know while I was researching this book. Like, I didn't know about the parade in 1913. I didn't know what happened at the end. I didn't know about the involvement of the labor union. I mean, I knew about the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory. And I knew that the amendment was passed, and I researched a lot of the political stuff in the political events. I didn't really talk about them in the book because I was so nervous that I didn't want the book to just sound like a history book. So it's very conscious of not writing too much about that because I didn't want people to get bored necessarily. But there was so much I didn't know, so much. And here I think, oh gosh, I did know a lot, but I really knew so little.
That's a really important point. And I think, personally, I think that historical fiction is a great way to teach history.
I know. I mean, I just
because,
like it. It's what I read. Like, I've read probably five historical fiction books in the last year. So it's really what I love.
and you know, you learn about some event that happens, or what happens to me sometimes, I'm reading and I'll read about some event and then I'm like, well, did that really happen? Is that really true? And so then I'll go look it up
I
and
know.
see if it really was.
I know.
And yeah,
I had a few
there's.
people who read my book who said, I didn't believe you that this happened. And then they Googled it and they were like, oh, yeah, you're right. It did. Which is good and bad. You know, it gives you, it's a little more pressure to make sure that you really have your facts correct.
That's true. That's true. You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Galia Gichon, and she is the author of The Accidental Suffragist, a novel. Galia, why don't you read a little bit from the book for us?
Okay, great. Helen walked in late to the cavernous hall at Cooper Union. She looked around the vast space with just a few pieces of furniture and paused. So much space here and so little in it. The wood gleamed, and she wondered how many women it took to keep it clean like that. She could barely keep the cobwebs out of the dark corners in her apartment. Alice Paul was standing on stage, already speaking. Helen did remember meeting her at Harriet's home the day of the fire, the day Abigail died. She couldn't recall if they'd spoken or what was Alice's role in the suffragist organization. She was surprised to see her commanding authority. Was she a leader like Harriet? The early evening light barely lit the room as the gas lights flickered. She saw an empty seat next to a lady dressed in a corseted silk dress, but instead sat in the back of the room. Helen looked around at the hundreds of seated women, many in white outfits and sashes. She was overcome with a moment with thoughts of Abigail. Her mind flashed back again to the parade they stumbled upon months ago, walking back from the market. She'd been listening to Abigail chatter about this and that when they began to hear chanting and cheers. They rounded a corner and there was a wall of people. They'd stumbled upon a large suffragist parade going up First Avenue. Her daughter had been fascinated with the marchers. She'd even talked of someday joining them. Standing in that immense hall, she was reminded. She told Abigail in no uncertain terms was she to get mixed up in that nonsense. It was too risky. But here she was herself. If Abigail could see her now, Helen felt tears prick her eyes and she looked down for a moment. She smelled their lilac perfume, listened to their polite clapping, watched them nod their heads and murmur in agreement, and compared their tempered cheers with her rougher neighborhood. Her faded dark outfit accentuated how out of place she was. Her armpits felt damp with sweat. When Mrs. Blatch had invited her, she knew she had to come. It was true, as she told Albert, she wanted to understand more about the suffragists because Abigail had been so captivated. It also seemed that the suffragists had some power in preventing an accident like the fire happening again. She desperately needed a distraction to take her mind off the grief of Abigail's death. Perhaps she had had her own stirring of the suffragette cause at the parade. "They said no one would join our cause, no one," Alice Paul exclaimed. "Do you know how many women have signed up?" she asked the audience. "100? 500? 1,000? 3,000? The audience called out. "No, 20,000. The crowd erupted with applause. Hats fell off heads. Hands were clapping in the air, and the floor shook with thunder. Helen found her own hands clapping alongside the crowd, caught up in the emotion. These are women from all walks of life, educated, immigrants, Gramercy Park to Delancey Street. Is Alice Paul telling the truth, Helen wondered. She looked around and was hard-pressed to see women like her from her neighborhood. These women even smelled different. Wait, out of the corner of her eye, she spotted a small, modest hat. Maybe there were women like her. She stood straighter and moved from the back of the room, a few inches closer to the heart of the crowd, feeling the heat of the audience and clapping her hands in unison. "They don't want us to vote. They don't want us to make decisions that matter. How are we supposed to vote for the politicians we agree with? How are we supposed to protect our families? We can't do that if we don't have the right to vote." Helen's eyes misted. It was too late for Abigail. She felt a pit in her stomach, nauseous, and hoped she wouldn't throw up. "We have a voice. We need to use it. They need to hear us. If not for us, then for our children." She thought about her children, Walter, Claudia, and Eleanor. It wasn't too late for them. They could have choices like these women. She couldn't leave now. She found herself merged with the group, adding her heat to the zeal of the crowd, not caring that she was sweating, that her hat was off her head, and was even tempted to roll up her sleeves, her sweat smelling more feral she hadn't bathed in over a week. As the meeting wrapped to a close, she felt a tap on her shoulder and turned around and found herself face to face with Harriet Stanton Blatch. "Mrs. Fox, do you have a few minutes to speak before you leave?" Helen nodded. She had already told Albert she would be late. She followed Harriet to a room in the back of the hall, feeling the air cool quickly as they walked away from the crowd. The chatter diminished and her ears popped from the quiet. The room was small, overstuffed. Boxes, piles of signs, and thick white ribbons were stacked to the ceiling. Mrs. Blatch immediately pulled out one of two chairs at a small table and sat down. "What's all this?" Helen asked. "Pamphlets, flyers, banners for our rallies and marches. Ooh, I'm tired. These late nights are catching up to my old bones," Harriet sighed. "What did you think of the speeches tonight?" Helen nodded her head with a small smile. "Alice Paul is tremendous. She really knows how to connect with women on every level. We're very fortunate to have her. You know she learned her suffrage tactics in England with Emmeline Pankhurst." Helen had no idea who she was, but assumed someone famous the way Harriet seemed impressed. Harriet continued, "We're in different parties. I founded the Equality League of Self-Supporting Women, and Alice has her congressional union. However, we have the same mission and work together all the time." She finally asked, "Helen, we are looking for more women to get involved with the suffragist cause, more women like you." "Well, I would like to attend another meeting or rally," Helen said. "That's not what I mean," Harriet continued. "We need women on the ground, working with our organization." "Why me?" Helen asked. "I see a resilience in you. I was not sure if you were going to come. It would be a challenge for anyone to move forward after the tragedy you've been through. But here you are. I believe that they, the politicians, men, need to hear your story from you." Helen nodded. Was she ready to share her grief, her anger with the public? "We need women from different parts of the city, such as your neighborhood." Helen took a deep breath, squinting her eyes. "You know, Mrs. Fox, my mother, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, was one of the original suffragists with Susan B. Anthony. And she died very tired. She devoted her life to the movement, neglecting my siblings and me tremendously so. We wouldn't be as progressive if it weren't for her, but she did die tired. We're trying to do it differently and register as many women as we can so we can see this to the finish line. The cause truly needs women like you."
she continued. What if your job and working for the suffragists were the same? Helen scrunched her face. The League is hiring with a salary, so you can continue to have a paycheck. Why not devote your hard work to us instead? How much will she pay me? Helen thought, looking down at her worn boots. We can pay a weekly salary of $12, Harriet offered. That's more than double what they pay me at the factory. Helen raised her eyebrows, but kept it to herself. What will Albert say when he finds out I'm making more than him, she thought. Was she really devoted to the suffragists, or was this just an outlet for her to right the wrong of Abigail's death? What would Abigail even say about her mother working for them? Why don't you sleep on it? Come by the office in the next few days and we can discuss more of the details. I'll be there every evening. Now, can I please drop you off with my carriage? Helen shook her head, finally able to speak. Thank you, Mrs. Blatch. Thank you for your belief. I'll get myself home. She had a lot of thinking to do. What was Albert going to say to all this?
And that was Galia Gachon reading from The Accidental Suffragist. So, $12 a week. I mean, that's just staggering to think about how little or how much
and that was
that,
double.
Yeah,
it was
and that
really
was
double.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. Well, I guess inflation has had a few years to make its way, but
yeah.
But now it's like $12 an hour isn't enough to live on.
I know. It's so true. So
wow.
True.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
So the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire is, I think it was a really a big turning point in unionization. Did the suffragists use it as part of their impetus also?
They did. And that's actually when I did my research that many of the suffragists started out as labor union activists, which, you know, it sort of makes sense. They're both causes that are very similar because think about who was being affected in the factories, women and children,
right.
Mostly. That's really who worked there and who was really being treated poorly. So many of the suffragists were labor union activists. So it actually, and in fact, it is a true fact that when the fire happened, many suffragists actually went down there, just whether to see what was happening or to see how they could help or support.
And that is how Helen got connected with them in the first place.
Yes.
Right.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's my fictional part where I can weave it in. It seems plausible, though, right?
It does. Yeah, it does. And when you were researching, tell us a little bit about the research process. Nowadays, of course, research is largely conducted on the internet. But did you go and look at source materials at all?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So I'll tell you two things that I did that I think were interesting. Is one is I actually went to my local library and kept checking out history. There's some great suffragist books. Just they're really more like a historical textbook, if you will. So there were two textbooks that I kept checking out. And literally, I would check them out for 3 weeks and renew them and check them out. And they were just tunes. Finally, I bought them. I thought, oh, this is ridiculous. I'm using this so much. So I purchased them. And those were really helpful for me to see the timeline. I mean, this started in the 1850s. Like, it was 70 years. I mean, if you think about that, that's a person's lifetime. More than that, if you think about it. Especially back then with lifespans. So, number one, I did use books. And then, second of all, I had a writing teacher. So, of course, I used the internet. And I didn't actually go visit any physical locations except for the tenement. Tenement Museum in New York City on the Lower East Side. I did go there. But the one of my writing teachers, he was a man, and one of my first ones, he was a man, he actually said to me, just which I thought was excellent advice, he said, when you're researching it, maybe don't read articles, but just look at pictures of that time, like of marches or rallies, because then you can write it in your own words. And it was the best advice. So I ended up really just, I mean, I probably have a file with hundreds of pictures that I just kept finding pictures on the internet, taking a screenshot, and then looking at that picture when I would write a chapter. And that I found really, really helpful because it's true. I think I was so nervous about reading things and then writing something and, you know, copying.
Right.
Which I didn't want to. I was so nervous about that. So that was the best advice, was just looking at pictures.
That's a fantastic idea. So
Yeah.
it's not quite the same as being there, but it's as close as you could get without having a time
Yeah.
machine.
Yeah. And especially with the parade and how, like, so there's in the book where there's women who actually walked from New York to D.C. And that was true. I can see the picture in my head. These four women that walked, it took them 3 weeks. And just how the women dressed at the parade, how the women dressed at rallies, how the women just dressed, the poor women versus the affluent, the wealthy women, how they dressed, the hats were different, the small hats, the big hats. I researched a lot about their clothing. I researched what the foods they ate, especially women who had money, who didn't.
Now, when
That
they
was
went to
fun.
Washington, tell me a little bit, let's t a little bit about sort of the historical context of that. And they were going to see, they felt like they had helped to elect President, was it Wilson?
Wilson.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so.
Yeah. So can you give a little context to that?
Yeah. So Alice Paul was a very, I would say, confrontational person, but she was a Quaker. So she actually did it with very, she was nonviolent, but she was, you know, not going to take the sitting down. She was like, we're not taking the sitting down. She's like, we have helped Wilson get elected. Let's have our own rally in Washington. She actually lived in Washington, in New York. And she said, let's have a rally in Washington. And she really had no idea that it would turn out to be as big as it was. And they, and just very smartly said, let's do it the day before the inauguration, because if we do it afterwards, most people will leave town. But at the time when people traveled, rarely did someone travel for the day of. They would come a few days before. Just travel took so long. And so she thought, if we can just capture them the day before the inauguration, and it was a brilliant move. And I think she thought maybe 1,000 people, or, and I think tens of thousands of people showed up. And it was just an event that was larger than itself. And she got a little bit of criticism because she raised some money for it. And people thought, well, you're raising money for just one parade, but it actually had such an impact. So.
And what year
was
this?
And I don't think, it was 1913.
1913.
Mm-hmm.
And how did they help President Wilson get elected?
Because he pseudo-promised them that he would help pass the vote. So they really put their force, because there were so many wealthy women, they put their force behind supporting him as their candidate.
And so they
helped
him
their husband.
Yeah, and helped campaign for him and probably donated money to his campaign.
Right.
Okay. Now, at that point,
all that fun stuff.
Were there any states that already, where women could already vote at that point?
You know what, don't quote me on it, because basically there were a few states out west that did pass the vote on a state basis. And I want to say it was, gosh, a little surprising, like Idaho or Colorado or one of those states.
Yeah, I was thinking Montana.
Yeah. Yes, yes. Again, don't quote me.
Yeah. So how did Wilson, when he got into office, what did he do? Did he follow up on his promise at all?
Well, he didn't, because World War One broke out, to be honest. So as soon as World War One broke out, everything stopped. It was anything, any effort monetarily, politically, was devoted to the war. So no, he did not fall through on his promise. And that's when they petition him at the end of the book, where they're literally, they become the silent sentinels. It's 1918, and they literally are rallying in front of the White House.
Wow.
Because it's been 4 years. Can you imagine that patience? 4 years.
Wow. But of course, because of the war, they got a lot of flack from people who maybe were somewhat supportive earlier.
Yeah.
But then it's like, oh, you're a traitor. You're being a traitor for not supporting the president during a war time.
Yeah. It was a very different time than today, I think.
Yeah.
Back then, it was a patriotism back then. It was, we're at war, we have to support the government from start to finish. There was no question about it.
So
you just didn't question the patriotism then.
Right. So the first state that allowed women to vote was Wyoming.
Okay, I knew it was a
a Western state, and
Western state that was not a typical Western state.
And it was in
that you would think of.
1869.
Yeah,
which is really
and a lot of the
early.
Western states did.
Yes.
It's amazing. They really did pass it on a state level.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Other states that did before 1920 were Utah, Colorado, Idaho, Washington, California,
yeah.
Oregon, Montana.
Yeah,
basically
amazing.
All the Western states. And New York. And New York did it before amendment went through.
And, you know, it's interesting how the amendment was passed. It's a great story. I didn't include it in the book, but I wish I had, or I didn't know how to, was basically there was a senator from New York who was in Tennessee, and in Nashville there's actually a statue for the suffragettes as a result, where he was a young senator. He was fairly new. He'd been newly elected, and I believe they needed 37 votes, and he was going to vote, and his mother called him, and she was like, you've got to do this. Like, what are you thinking? Because I don't think he was going to. He was on the fence. And he was from a well-to-do family, as most of the senators were. And she's like, you've got to vote for this. This is ridiculous. Like, don't come home if you don't. And she convinced him of it, and Tennessee was the state that ratified it.
Oh, wow. I'm looking at a website right now that shows the states that ratified it. It looked like the first state that ratified it was Wisconsin. And the last state that they have is
I believe it's Tennessee. Mm-hmm.
Although maybe Tennessee might have been the one that put them over, and then other states later ratified it belatedly. Like Louisiana rejected it and didn't ratify it until 1970. There's a lot of states that didn't ratify until 1969 or 70.
Mm.
Oh, my gosh.
I know. It's hard to fathom, right?
Yeah.
Hard to fathom.
Yep. So Tennessee was the 36th state making it, you know, then, and that was on August 18th, 1920. And it came, Washington was, and there was a huge, all these states that ratified it up through March of 1920. And starting with, what did I say the first one was? June of 1919. So from June 1919 to March 1920, they got all but one that was needed. And then they didn't get that one until months later. thanks to that mother.
I know. She called her son and said, you better do this or else.
Wow. Five months later. Wow. Yeah. So, Galia, tell us a little bit about your writing process. Like, do you write every day, or, you know, I know you said this is not your day job, but, you know, do you?
Yeah, so I write a few ways. First of all, writing class, I'm not new, but my writing class is now a prompt class, and I'm finding my writing is even deeper from it, because while I am working on a ongoing novel, the prompts really, I feel like, bring in an element of creativity that I didn't have.
Do you ever find that you know, you write something in response to a prompt that you can later incorporate in some way into your novel?
Oh, no. I'm 100% incorporating. No,
oh,
no, I do.
Oh.
100% incorporating it. So that's one. And then two, I live in, I live outside of New York City. I'm about an hour. And I've started taking the train again, and I find the train for me is a great place to write. I really love it. I love that I'm on the train for an hour. I know it's a set hour. I don't like to use my phone on the train. I might do some emails. I might read, but I just find it's like a captive hour. And I actually find it's a great place for me to write. I have an iPad with a keyboard, so I'm not dragging my heavy computer in. So I would say that I would try to do the writing class once a week, and then the train once or twice a week. And then I used to travel. I I don't necessarily just sit at home every day and write. That doesn't work for me. I have to go someplace and do something. So if I'm really motivated, I will go to a coffee shop or I go to the library or, and you know, I also, like, I live in a busy house. I've got two children. I've got three stepchildren. So it's, you know, and they're teenagers, but we have five kids. I work from home. There's laundry. There's dogs. And I find that when I'm sitting at home working, or if I go to a co-working space, it's like I have to focus on my day job versus like, okay, I'm going to go to the coffee shop now and work. I'm going to go to the city and work. So that's when I would write or get on a plane and travel.
So isn't that kind of like the romantic author dream of sitting in a coffee shop and writing?
I love it. I did it.
Yeah.
Because, first of all, it's like I treat myself. I get, you know, a fancy cup of coffee. And I say, you know, I know that I'm free from 2 to 4. So I'll just go and write from 2 to 4. And I will go there with that purpose versus like, I don't just go to a coffee shop and work my day job. I work in my home office or work in my co-working space. But going to the coffee shop is like removing myself from, because usually if I'm sitting down, it's like you have your day job. I'm like, oh, I should email that client. I have to get ready for that presentation or, you know, things like that that I find get in the way.
Right. And yeah, it's very hard to be creative when you're in the environment where you would normally focus on work, I think.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, do you get distracted by conversations in the coffee shop or – do you incorporate them into your work too?
No, it's funny. Somebody else asked me that. No. No. I find that I think if I can get past the first 10, 15 minutes, then I'm just in the zone. If anything, I get distracted because I live in a small town. And so I see people.
Yeah.
And someone will come up to my table and say, oh, I haven't seen you in so long.
Right. Yeah. Do you have a favorite coffee shop?
You know, it's funny, like before COVID, there was this one Starbucks that I really liked. But we, since COVID, believe it or not, we actually, there's two new coffee shops that opened up that I love. One is, it's actually called Green and Tonic and Gigi and Joe. So they're independent, locally owned. And one actually is vegan and has good vegan food. So I can get lunch or dinner there.
Wow.
It feels like a treat because I think working for yourself and working from home, I don't eat out a lot. Like I'm usually at home. So I go to, like I said, I just, you know, bring my lunch to my co-working space. So it's kind of a treat.
Of course, the real romantic author dream is sitting in a coffee shop writing in Paris, right?
So, yes, in Paris. But you know what else I do sometimes, which I do, and I realized I forgot to do, I used to do it, is I would actually write, I most of the time type, but I write pen and paper. And my writing group, or it's a writing center, they have classes, it's wonderful, it's called the Westport Writers Workshop. So we actually did a day, we live on the beach here, so we did a day at the beach about 3 weeks ago, and I got there and my iPad wasn't charged. And so I had to write with a pen and paper, and it was great. It was wonderful. And I've done it before where I've written in a pad with a pen and paper.
Yes, and it is a different process, isn't it, mentally?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
Now,
I feel closer to it, to be honest, which doesn't always make sense, but.
Mm-hmm. No, I think there's something about how the thoughts are flowing, you know, in through the mind into the pen on paper that's different than the way it is through a keyboard. But mm-hmm. but keyboard is usually more efficient, maybe a little faster. Mm-hmm. But I used to love writing and on paper, and then you have all these scratching out and arrows and, you know, pointing things.
And
but then interpreting it later could be a little tricky.
I know. And I have to like transcribe it.
Yes. Yeah. You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Galia Gishon, and she is the author of The Accidental Suffragist. So at what point did you know you were going to publish this book, and how did you go about finding your publisher?
Oh, do you have an hour?
Oh, maybe I should have asked that question first.
I know. Gosh, that's a tough question. I'm pretty goal-oriented, so I think early on I knew that I wanted to publish it as a book. or I wanted to try to publish it. It was really my goal. And God, good or bad, I kept getting feedback from people in my writing class saying, oh my gosh, you got to publish this. You got to publish this. So falsely or not, I thought, okay, great. I will try to do this. And then again, like I took classes on, well, just back end a little bit, that I didn't write this book with the intent of getting published, nor did I write this book with the intent of agents or publishers seeing it. Because I think if you do, you're writing a different book.
Mm.
I really wrote this because I love the story. I wanted to write, and I wanted this to be, like, I wrote for myself versus the reader.
Mm.
So that's a little bit my thought process on it. I think you write differently when you write for, I know people are going to read this.
Yeah. Now, you were, because you were taking writing classes, were you sharing the writing all along?
Oh, yeah. Which is, some agents ask that because I would literally rewrite. I rewrote the book 3 times because things don't jive, things don't work, people don't like characters, they feel characters should be. Yeah, there's so many reasons. So, yeah, absolutely. So that's number one. And then two, so once I decided that I want it published, I took classes on that. I took classes on how to write the query letter. I hired an editor to help me with the query letter. I took classes on how to pitch agents. It's a process. I didn't know anything about that.
Mm.
I actually had published a nonfiction book 10 years ago, but it's a completely different process, completely different.
So what are the most important takeaways from what you learned in that process?
Well, I think number one is you are really pitching to agents who know your genre, and you don't want to make the mistake, and you have to follow, you have to be organized, and you have to be detail oriented, because I literally kept a spreadsheet of every agent I pitched to, every agent I reached out to, when I heard from them, what their website was. And that was really helpful for me. And then I think you have to, unfortunately, you just can't cut and paste. It's time consuming to go on their website. Some of them want the subject matter a certain way, caps, no caps. Literally, they want one chapter. They want the whole book right away. They want a form filled out. I mean, it is very, very time consuming.
And how
so
did,
you have to really pay attention.
How did you identify which agents you wanted to approach?
So first of all, you can Google it. You can just Google agents historical fiction, and literally dozens come up. But I think I went through Publishers Marketplace, which I think I paid for, and if I did, it wasn't a lot of money.
Right.
Yeah,
and,
I'm pretty sure I used them.
And how many agents did you approach before you got the first yes?
So I'll be honest, I did not get an agent. I ended up not getting an agent, and I pitched this to an independent publisher, which is another way to go. And so I had good luck with agents. I'll be honest with you. I had, 5 or 7 agents who said yes, they wanted to read the book, which is a wonderful sign, wonderful sign. And I had one agent say no because she had just purchased a book of a suffragist. So I thought, okay, well, at least that's the market.
Yeah.
So I thought that was good. And I think that's the Women's March book, which maybe I shouldn't talk about that too much, but that's another book that's out. So I think that just knowing that I had one agent who said no, but very generously wrote me a 2-page constructive criticism of the book, which I so appreciate. She was right. She was like, this isn't working. But she's like, I love the book. I'm passing, but here's just my feedback. And it was so helpful.
Oh,
it was wow. It was so generous, frankly. Yeah. So ultimately these agents said no, but they were very kind about it. They were like, we love it, but here's why we're saying no. And I do think that if I kept at it, but then I think I can't remember, you really need community as a writer if you're going to get published. And I started talking to someone else in my town who had published some books, and she said, why don't you, she actually gave me the idea. She said, why don't you reach out to independent publishers? And literally the first one I reached out to said yes.
Oh, wow. Great.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
what's mm-hmm. that experience been like for you working with an independent publisher?
Oh, it's been wonderful. Wonderful. It's Wyatt McKenzie. They're out of Oregon. Nancy owns it. She's been doing it for 25 years. She's been wonderful. They've been great. They helped me with the cover, with the editor, with the book, the author blurbs, distribution. Yeah, they've been wonderful. It's been a great, great experience, great process.
So tell us about the cover.
Like, well, I think it's really the intersection of a woman who's a suffragist and then the daughter that she loses. It captures that. I had said that I wanted a picture of a woman. I wanted both of those on there. And truthfully, Nancy just, or the woman that was helping me at the time from the publishing, she said, just show me books that you like.
Oh, cool.
And I did.
Oh,
and
cool.
So that was how we came up with it. It's like sometimes the easiest way to do that.
So you were able to have a lot of input into what the cover would end up being.
Oh, yeah. So much.
Yeah.
So much.
That's great. And how was the editing process with your publisher? Was there a lot of back and forth?
Yeah, no, it was wonderful. So I'll be honest with you, too, is that I actually, when I was done and I had friends read it, I had beta readers. I mean, I really went through the process. But I also had, I hired a professional editor, which is just well worth every cent I spent on her. And she's somebody that used to work at Random House, so she really knew the industry. But then the publisher had an editor, and it was great. It was just, it was wonderful. It was grammar and content, which are two different editing processes.
Right.
Processes.
Absolutely. And so now you had, because you had published before, you'd probably worked with professional editors before too. So did you ever have any ego clash with your editors?
No, I don't have a big ego. No, no, some, you know, once in a blue moon, they're like, this doesn't make sense. I'm like, yes, it does. You don't know. But no, not at all.
Well, that's good. That's good.
Yeah.
Now, are you comfortable talking about what you're working on next?
You know, it's funny. I was talking about it last night. So I have an idea for historical fiction, but that's not what I'm working on right now. So this is a contemporary novel. It's a young woman in her 20s who works in finance, but she's very disenchanted with the financial industry, Wall Street, and wants to do good in the world, but she also has student loans to pay off, and so she has to continue working in the financial services industry on Wall Street, and she ends up going to work for a woman, a venture capitalist who's a woman, and that's not all that she thinks it's going to be either.
Oh, okay. So is
that's
there
it for now.
Is there anything autobiographical in this one?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I worked on Wall Street, but it was in the 90s, so it's very different from 2021. And no, I think just her experience working on Wall Street a little bit and just how it's like male-centric is probably the only – but look, I did work there 10 years. I was – you know, for many years, the only woman in my department.
So how did you get involved in angel investing?
You know, I've been very focused on financial empowerment for women and financial education for women. And to me, that really leads to independence. Whether you're married, single, doesn't matter. I started when I left Wall Street and wanted to work for myself because I had children, I wanted to really focus on financial education for women, and that's what my day job is. But then really this opportunity, I am an entrepreneur. I love entrepreneurship. My mother, actually both my parents are entrepreneurs. And so literally this class came across my email probably 7-8 years ago on how to be an angel investor and learn about it. And it was very focused on women only. And I just signed up. I was like, oh my gosh, I have to do it. A no-brainer, and I haven't stopped.
Oh, cool.
And I literally, my call today from 1 to 3 are all angel investments. I've done 3 deals this summer, and I only do women-led or impact or BIPOC founders. I don't think we have a choice in terms of if we want to help women do better in this economy.
Well, what are impact startups? I'm not even sure what that term means.
So it's an angel investment that focuses on a social impact cause. So it's specifically, like if I had to define it, there's 17 of the SDG goals for the UN. So these are for-profit companies, but maybe it's climate change or gender equality or racial equality, fair trade, fair pay, clean water, so many. There's education. So if it's a company, a for-profit company, that that's their goal. So, for example, one of the companies I looked at this summer is founded by a Black woman, and she has a digital video where she does digital videos on mental health education in the classroom. And she is, and so there's so many reasons why, between like bullying and class and LGBT issues. And she's now in the 8 biggest states in the country. She sold it into their school system.
Wow. Wow. You still would rather be writing.
Well, I probably would like to have more time to write. I actually love this part of my job because I feel like I'm really helping women in our economy.
Oh, yeah.
But I probably would like to have a little more time to write, to be honest.
Wow. Well,
and I like taking classes. I'm really, like, I wish I could take more classes.
Really?
Those I love.
Have you ever come to
the
University of Iowa Summer Writing Festival? They have great
week-long
and weekend classes.
I know. I know. One of my best friends that I grew up with, we did our own little writer's retreat about a month ago.
Oh, very cool.
So we went away for just 2 or 3 days, and I spent the two afternoons writing. It was great.
Oh.
It was at a yoga place. We did yoga in the morning and then wrote in the afternoon.
Oh, that sounds a pretty ideal.
That's great. It was amazing.
Well, Galia, I want to thank you for being with us today, and we're out of time. Do you have any final words of advice for people who want to write?
You know, I think if you really want to write, either put that time on your calendar or write every day. I don't write every day, but I have in the past when I've needed a deadline. But I would say also just put it on your calendar. I do find, for me, saying, oh, gosh, I have it from 2 to 3. Okay, I'll do it.
Mm-hmm. That's a great suggestion. And we have a closing quote. Caroline usually does these, but since she's not here today, I found one about history from Martin Luther King Jr. We are not makers of history. We are made by history.
Mm-hmm. I love it.
So thanks again, and see you all next week on Writer's Voices.
All right. Thank you so much, Monica. Thank you.